Hello, this is Terrence McNally, and today two half-hour interviews. First, a new one recorded July 26th with constitutional scholar and Dean of Berkeley Law, Erwin Chemerinsky, on the Roberts Gorsuch Supreme Court and the many legal issues raised by the rule and precedent-breaking Trump presidency. In the second half, as Trump sends more troops to Afghanistan, my November 2009 conversation with Matthew Ho, former Marine captain with combat experience in Iraq, who resigned his post in the Foreign Service in protest over the Afghan war.
I'll be joined today by Erwin Chemerinsky, constitutional scholar and Dean of Berkeley Law. We're recording this interview July 26th. After hosting and producing this show for 17 years, I stepped aside a couple of years ago from recording new live interviews, and since then I've dug into the archives to stream one of the relevant earlier interviews each week on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And podcasts of years of interviews are available to listen to anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic, or at my site, aworldthatjustmightwork.com or terrencemcnally.net. They're the same site. But following the election of Donald Trump, I have felt I cannot resist exploring the path forward and confronting him and his administration. First off today, I want to offer you a few websites for information on how to actively participate in resistance to Trump and the movement toward a healthy, progressive future we so desperately need. And you can email me at temcnally@mac.com to get these websites and more. First, indivisibleguide.com, ourrevolution.com, the one that's started by the Bernie Siegel campaign, moveon.org, which has expanded beyond just online organizing to really work with folks on the ground as well, fivecalls.org, which tells you what important calls you might want to make to your representatives, townhallproject.com, which tells you when your local representatives might be having town halls in their districts, and couragecampaign.org, which is active primarily in the state of California. Erwin Chemerinsky became Dean of Berkeley Law just July 1st. From 2008 to 2017, he was the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at UC Irvine School of Law. And prior to that, he was a law professor at Duke University and before that at the University of Southern California. He's the author of more than 200 law review articles and 10 books, including The Case Against the Supreme Court and two books published in 2017, Closing the Courthouse Doors, How Your Constitutional Rights Became Unenforceable, and Free Speech on Campus, written with Howard Gilman. In 2017, National Jurist magazine named him as the most influential person in legal education in the United States. Welcome, Erwin Chemerinsky, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Thank you for the kind introduction. It's really an honor and pleasure to talk with you.
Wonderful. I like folks to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So can you just briefly talk about your path to the work you find yourself doing today? And feel free to mention mentors or turning points, moments of decision along the way.
Sure. I grew up in a working-class family on the south side of Chicago. Neither my parents nor brother or sister had ever gone to college. I certainly had mentors who made an enormous difference in my life. I had a high school teacher and high school debate coach who had an enormous impact, and still in touch with him to this day. I went to Northwestern for college, to Harvard for law school. I was inspired to go to law school by the civil rights lawyers of the 1950s and the 1960s. I wanted to be a public interest lawyer. I did that for a short time and then became a law professor in 1980. So I'm about to start my 38th year as a law professor. And I've done it, as you mentioned, in a number of different places, most recently coming here to Berkeley July 1st to be dean and a member of the faculty.
Okay, that move from being the founding dean at Irvine to moving to Berkeley, you'd been in Southern California, counting USC and Irvine, for really most of your career. Why the move at this moment?
I had already publicly said that next year was to be my last year as dean at University of California, Irvine School of Law. Next year would have been my 10th year officially as dean. And it's time for the law school to go through a reexamination. And I'm not the person to lead that reexamination. I've always felt 10 years is the optimal time to be a dean. And the opportunity at Berkeley came along just as I was thinking through the question of, what do I want to do next? This is a terrific law school. It's part of a great university. I can use what I've learned over the last 10 years, but also in a very different context.
Very good. And I want to spend most of our time today on the current issues raised by the Trump administration and the current Supreme Court. But first, could you tell us briefly, just so listeners get a feel for this, about the two books that you published this year?
Sure. One book came out early this year. It's titled Closing the Courthouse Door, How the Supreme Court Has Made Your Constitutional Rights Unenforceable. And the theme here is that over the last couple of decades, in a series of decisions, the Supreme Court has made it ever harder for people who have suffered violations of constitutional rights, even severe injuries, to be able to sue. The Supreme Court has made it harder to sue government and government officials. The court has limited who has standing to sue. The court has made it much harder to sue corporations, enforcing arbitration clauses. And the whole is very troubling. We all learned that if somebody's injured, they should get their day in court. But all too often now, that's a myth. The other book, which is going to be published next month, is about free speech on campus. I co-authored it with the chancellor at the University of California, Irvine, Howard Gilman. And the thesis of this book is what college universities need to do is both protect robust freedom of speech and make sure that campuses are inclusive environments where all students feel safe and protected. And what we try to do is review the history of speech on campus and offer our specific thoughts what campuses can and can't and shouldn't do.
Okay. On that second one, this obviously has been a source of controversy in the last couple of years. Trigger warnings, demonstration, all sorts of things. I can imagine you're trying to thread a needle there. Where do you feel you come down?
Well, we very much discuss exactly the things that you're talking about, things like trigger warnings, safe spaces, the desire to make sure that students are protected and included, but also protect free speech. The bottom line in terms of where we come down is that all ideas and views can be expressed on campus, no matter how offensive, but that campuses can take steps to try to make sure that students have their own opportunity to speech and that students also feel that it's a campus that cares about them and is protecting them.
Very good. Okay, let's turn to the Supreme Court. First of all, how unprecedented, just to remind folks, was the GOP refusal to even consider Obama's selection of Merrick Garland?
It was unprecedented, period. Before 2016, 24 times in American history, there was a vacancy during the last year of a president's term. In 21 of 24, the Senate confirmed. In three instances, the Senate denied confirmation. Never before had the Senate said, no hearings, no vote. Of course, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that just hours after Justice Scalia died. The Republicans never wavered. This really was a stolen seat, and it's going to have effect for decades to come.
Yeah, I mean, when I look at presidential elections, I think the two most critical things are war and peace and the Supreme Court. You know, there are lots else going on, but those to be the two big ones. How did they get away with this? What does it tell us about the media, the opposition party, public attention? You get where I'm going. I mean, it's something this unprecedented and this critical seemed to not even be a big deal.
They got away with it because the American people were willing to tolerate it, that it's very hard to make the Supreme Court an election issue. You're absolutely right. Who the president puts on the Supreme Court, who the president puts on the lower federal courts, are the most long-lasting legacy of any presidency. Neil Gorsuch is 49 years old.
Oh.
If he remains on the Supreme Court until he's 90, the age was just John Paul Stevens retired. Gorsuch will be Supreme Court Justice for 41 years. That would be until the year 2058. William Rehnquist was appointed by President Richard Nixon in 1971 and served on the court until he passed away in 2005. John Paul Stevens was appointed by Gerald Ford in 1975 and remained on the court until he retired in 2010. Now, you focus on the Supreme Court, and that's what we're talking about, but keep in mind that President Trump is likely to fill a quarter and a third of all the seats on the federal district courts and federal courts of appeals. These are individuals, too, who are going to be there for decades, long after Trump is president.
Yeah, I must say that one of the things I think watching at the chaos in the administration in terms of passing legislation and so on, that I think this is going to be the most important legacy unless something truly tragic happens. Let's talk again. This is a quote about a recent decision and some recent decisions. We're talking here about church and state, and I'm reading from your writing. Never before has the Supreme Court allowed secular corporations to claim religious freedom. People create corporations to protect themselves from liability. By making the corporations a separate entity, the investors are liable only to the extent of their investment. The corporation is an entity that is treated as legally separate from the individuals who run it or own it. And yet, that's not what's happening. This is Hobby Lobby, right? But how big, Irwin, is this going to get? With the court as currently constructed, with the possible addition of another Gorsuch, how far is this going to go?
I think the place where the current court is most likely to dramatically change constitutional law, and it's already happening, is with regard to issues of separation of church and state. On June 26th, just a few weeks ago, the Supreme Court, for the first time in history, found that the government was constitutionally required to provide assistance to religious schools. I think we're now going to see religious institutions suing any time they're denied things that are provided to secular private institutions. A couple of years ago, the Supreme Court said it was constitutional for a city-town board to invite Christian clergy members to all of their meetings over a many-year period to deliver explicitly Christian prayers. You mentioned Hobby Lobby, where the Supreme Court held that a company could refuse to provide contraceptive coverage to women employees because the company's owner's religious beliefs. There's a case before the Supreme Court next term, it'll be argued in the fall, Masterpiece Cake Shop versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission, about whether or not a baker can refuse to make a cake for a gay couple. And I worry that this would then open the door for people being able to discriminate whenever they want by saying it's part of the religious views.
Mm-hmm. And that second case you were talking about was the Trinity Lutheran Church of Columbia versus Comer?
Exactly.
And that's the one where they said that if they were going to if the government was going to subsidize playing fields or parking lots in public schools, they had to be willing to do so for religious schools as well.
And in fact, Chief Justice Roberts concluded by saying, it is odious to deny religious institutions what's provided to secular institutions. Justice Sotomayor wrote a blistering dissent saying, never before in history had the Supreme Court found that the Constitution requires the government to provide aid to religious institutions. It was long the case that federal governments, state governments, local governments provide aid to private secular organizations, whether it's for daycare or drug and alcohol rehabilitation. If a religious institution wanted the aid, it would have to create a secular arm. President George W. Bush tried to champion something called charitable choice to allow secular religious institutions to get the same aid as secular institutions. What the Supreme Court now is doing is saying that's a constitutional requirement.
Right. And as you point out, Sandra Day O'Connor, when speaking about this, said, those who would renegotiate the boundaries between church and state must therefore answer a difficult question. Why would you trade a system that has served us so well for one that has served others so poorly? And I'm afraid we're on that trail right now. In another religious legal question here, what's your feeling or your reviews of the Muslim bans and the rulings applied to them?
I think that as virtually every court has ruled, they are unconstitutional. The United States Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit, an opinion by Judge Roger Gregory, said that they're dripping with religious animus. I think it's clear they were motivated by a desire to discriminate on the grounds of religion. The federal court on the West Coast, the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, said that they violate federal law. There's a 1965 immigration statute that specifically says that there cannot be discrimination in immigration policy based on national origin, and that's what the Trump policy does. The Supreme Court is going to hear these cases in October. Three justices, Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch, have already said they're going to uphold the entirety of the travel ban. I think it's going to really come down, as everything does, to Anthony Kennedy, maybe to John Roberts.
Okay. And Any thoughts also about the I would say almost bizarre, but certainly nothing I've seen, I think, in my lifetime, Trump's relationship with the judiciary, belittling them, basically telling people that they will be to blame if there's a successful terror attack?
I think President Trump's attack on the judiciary is unprecedented. Think of the federal district court judge in Washington who found that the Trump travel ban was likely unconstitutional and issued a preliminary injunction. President Trump responded to that by saying he's a so-called judge. When a judge in San Diego was handling the case concerning Trump College, Trump University, President Trump said that he's biased because he's of Latino heritage. When the federal judge in Hawaii issued a preliminary injunction against Travel Ban 2.0, one of Trump's top aides referred to it as a judge out on an island in the Pacific, and forgetting that Hawaii is a part of the United States.
Oh, my God.
My concern is there are relatively few institutions that can check the president. Congress, but this Congress isn't going to do so. The federal courts, the media. And President Trump is so aggressively trying to undermine the credibility, the legitimacy of these institutions. And that's the path to an authoritarian society.
Yeah. In a book that that I interviewed you about when it came out, which I was quite impressed with, your book, The Case Against the Supreme Court, you basically said that the Supreme Court, you make the case that throughout its history, the court has overwhelmingly favored corporate power over employees, consumers, the public, has favored government power over individual rights. Talk just a bit about that, and isn't the Roberts Court, with the addition of Gorsuch, with fellows like Alito, about as pro-business as a court could be?
In fact, a study was done, and it was done by people with impeccable credentials. Richard Posner, who's a University of Chicago law professor and a federal court of appeals judge in Chicago, William Landis, an economist at the University of Chicago, and Lee Epstein, professor at Washington University in St. Louis. And they, by a number of different measures, found that the Roberts Court is the most pro-business court that we've had since the mid-1930s. And since then, I think the court has become even more conservative and more pro-business. For the longer term, the real question is going to be, will Justice Kennedy, Justice Ginsburg, Justice Breyer remain until the end of the Trump presidency?
Mm-hmm.
If any one of those three justices leaves the bench between now and January 20th, 2021, that will be a dramatic ideological shift. That will make the court even more pro-business, probably, than it's ever been.
Yeah, one thing that I always notice when there are confirmation hearings and talks about confirmation hearings, people, the media and the public, I think, influenced by the media, seem to talk the most about abortion, gun control, and so on, when in fact, to me, for the last 20 years, it has been the pro-business approach of the court that's the most concerning and really transforms the relationship of citizens to their country.
I think that's right. Just think of Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, which held that corporations have the right to spend from their corporate treasuries unlimited amounts of money to get candidates elected or defeated. Or you mentioned the case of Hobby Lobby, where the Supreme Court for the first time said that corporations have free exercise rights. As you quoted me as saying, corporations are fictional entities. They can't have religious beliefs, and yet the Supreme Court has protected their ability to deny contraceptive coverage to women. I worry they'll next year say that corporations have the right to discriminate based on religion. And these are just a few examples. The Supreme Court has made it so hard to sue generic drug companies, even when the products inflict great injuries. The court has made it almost impossible in many cases for consumers or employees or medical patients to sue because of the court's aggressive enforcement of arbitration clauses.
Okay, and I will just say, by the way, we've mentioned Kennedy, who is 80 and who is perhaps the most likely to retire during Trump's term. He's our swing vote, and the way you prove that he's a swing vote is the last year he voted in the majority 98% of the cases. That indicates he's almost always on the winning side. And yet, for people who look at to him as the hope, he did write the Citizens United decision.
And Kennedy is now 81. He turned that on July 23rd. There are many rumors that he's going to leave the bench. Ruth Bader Ginsburg is 84. Stephen Breyer will turn 79 on August 15th. The question is it realistic that all three of these justices will still be on the court on January 20th, 2021, at the end of the Trump presidency?
And of course, with this Congress, we won't see any Merrick Garland refusal to consider. Let's switch to, more specifically, to Trump. You're co-counsel for the emoluments suit filed by the public interest group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. First of all, remind people, what is an emolument, and what does the law forbid?
There are two provisions of the Constitution that are relevant here that use this word emoluments. I think until relatively recently, most people thought an emolument was a skin cream. Article 1, Section 9 says that no person who holds a position of trust in the federal government may receive a present or an emolument from a foreign state. Emolument means benefit. The concern was that foreign governments would exercise too much influence over the new nation. Article 2, Section 1 says the president cannot receive any emoluments from the federal government other than the salary paid for the office. Here the concern was that the president might use the position to benefit personally. The lawsuit says, since taking office on January 20th this year, President Trump has been constantly receiving benefits from foreign states. He's been constantly receiving benefits from the federal government other than the salary that he's paid for the office. And the lawsuit simply says, we want the federal court to declare that what President Trump is doing is unconstitutional and to enjoin him, to force him to comply with the Constitution.
Now, by the way, although we find it outrageous how much is being spent at Mar-a-Lago and on travel and Secret Service for his sons when they go on business trips and so on, it isn't even exactly that, right? In other words, that's sort of an expanded version of what most presidents get. But it's the fact that foreign governments are choosing to stay at Trump hotels as a way potentially of currying favor. It's that kind of thing more specifically, right?
Well, it's all of that. No one can object to Secret Service protection for the president, even though it's expensive. But the problem is when the president is staying at the hotel that he owns, he's then benefiting from every Secret Service agent who at government expenses renting a room. So I'm not objecting to the dollars being spent to protect the president. I'm objecting that a good portion of those dollars are going to end up personally benefiting the president. Likewise, with regard to foreign states, there's a great deal of evidence now that foreign governments are renting from Trump properties rather than competitor hotels for just the reason you say, to curry favor with the president. I'll give you an example. Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., is on the site of the old post office. Donald Trump, in his own name, owns 76% of the interest in this hotel. His children own the others. It's not even a corporation or some kind of front for it. It's just in his name. Every time a foreign government rents space there, Donald Trump is profiting. That violates the Emoluments Clause.
Mm-hmm. And why is no one enforcing this, and what are the methods of enforcing this?
Ultimately, the court has to enforce it. I mean, short of that, it would be Congress impeaching and removing him, and the Republican Congress isn't going to do that, and certainly not about the Emoluments Clause. There are three lawsuits that have been filed against President Trump for violating the Emoluments Clause. There's the one that was filed by Citizens Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, filed on January 23rd. There's a lawsuit that was filed by 200 members of Congress, and there's a separate lawsuit filed by some state attorney generals.
So there's three prongs. All will they end up uniting, or will they be taken up in different courts?
Ultimately, I think this is going to get to the Supreme Court, and I'm not sure there's going to be any mechanism for uniting them until that point. But in the end, the Supreme Court has to decide, will we allow the president to violate the Constitution? I think the most important aspect of the rule of law is that no one, not even the president, is above the law.
Yeah, this particularly is something which seems to chafe Donald Trump, and he points to the fact that the president is not singled out specifically in conflict of interest writings, as if that means he cannot, there is no such thing as a conflict of interest with the president. You contend that's not correct, right?
Well, of course there can be a conflict of interest that applies to the president. Whether a specific statute applies to the president is a different question. But President Trump's statement that says that there's no such thing as a conflict of interest with the president isn't just another way of his trying to say, I'm above the law.
Right.
The law doesn't apply to me. And that just can't be right. So the emoluments clauses that we're talking about are very clear. One says for any person who holds a position of trust in the federal government, surely the President of the United States holds a position of trust. The other says that the president can't do something. Can't be clearer than that, saying the president can't receive any benefits from the federal government other than his salary.
Okay. As I said, we're recording on July 26th, and in my research, I didn't find anything you'd written about impeachment since May 5th. And the headline I saw for that article, is it time to start talking about impeachment? Well, now nearly 12 weeks later, is it?
I think at this stage, the key is for Robert Mueller's investigation to go forward. Mueller is investigating whether President Trump, whether high-level campaign officials, whether high-level government officials violated the law. My great fear, of course, is that President Trump is going to order the firing of Special Prosecutor Mueller. And that in itself, I think, would warrant impeachment investigation. But until then, I think, or until other things happen, we need to see where the criminal investigation goes and what it yields.
And these criminal investigations are notoriously slow. I mean, that's part of, it's almost the nature of them. They are such in-depth investigations. Give some people a sense of how long this might take.
I wish I knew. Mueller has put together a terrific team. If I was to put together the A-list of who I would want to investigate this type of matter, that's who Mueller has on his team. The reason I think we need to wait for this is with a Republican House and a Republican Senate, there's no realistic possibility, based on what we know now, that there's going to be impeachment proceedings. But that will all change if it turns out that there's evidence that the president has violated criminal statutes. So rather than expend a lot of energy at this point on something that's going to go nowhere, I would say let the investigation go forward. How long will it take? I don't think any of us know at this point.
Right. And I, by the way, I certainly agree with you that it's almost a distraction to spend a lot of energy and a lot of people's enthusiasm and commitment on something which the Congress is in charge of. And as you say, until there's something that's so clear that even they have to act. What about if there's a crisis? By that, intentional or otherwise. I recently interviewed Mark Danner about his book Spiral, Trapped in the Forever War, about the War on Terror, and he makes the point that Obama normalized a lot of what Bush and Cheney had done rather than hold anyone accountable, leaving Trump with a lot of dangerous and many previously illegal options when it comes from responding to terror. What are your thoughts about that, if there were a terror attack or something of that ilk?
My great fear is that if there were a terror attack, President Trump would use it as a basis for claiming authoritarian rule, and he might have supported the country in doing this. If there's another 9/11 or the kind of terrorist attacks that occurred in Europe, I think President Trump's impulse is going to be to try to claim more unchecked power. And we know that in times of crisis, history demonstrates that presidents do this and they're able to get away with it. The Patriot Act was adopted because of 9/11. And I don't know that we've had a president, maybe since Richard Nixon or Vice President Dick Cheney, who had such authoritarian impulses as Donald Trump. So I'm very worried about that.
Okay. This would be the final question. We've got about a minute and a half here, Irwin. What should people be focusing on? What should people, there's a lot of issues here, and a lot of people, I think, are a little intimidated by you know, legal doctrine and so on. What should people, where should people's eye be for the next few months right now?
Do you remember a book called Future Shock that talked about
Absolutely.
The problem is so much happening that's greatly troubling, very hard to process it? That's really the Trump administration. I mean, so what do we need to process? We're focused on. We need to focus on were federal laws violated with regard to Russia's involvement in the 2016 presidential campaign? We need to know. It's about the integrity of the electoral system. It's about the rule of law. Obviously, we all have to focus on health care. It's deeply disturbing that a bill could get adopted that caused 20 million people to lose their health care coverage. We need to focus on what the Trump administration is doing with regard to the environment. I worry because all these other things are dominating the headlines. Not enough focus is being paid to how environmental regulations are being repealed, how everything about climate change has been taken down from federal agency websites, how we have a head of the EPA who denies the very existence of climate change. And these are just the start of the kind of things we need to be focusing on.
Okay, so again, the website is law.berkeley.edu. The most recent books are Closing the Courthouse Doors, How Your Constitutional Rights Became Unenforceable, and Free Speech on Campus, which comes out next week. Thank you, Erwin Chemerinsky. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, and I'd love to do this again.
This is Terrence McNally. In the second half, as Trump sends more troops to Afghanistan, you'll hear my November 2009 conversation with Matthew Ho, a former Marine captain with combat experience in Iraq, who resigned his post in the Foreign Service in protest over the Afghan war.
Matthew Ho, the Iraq war vet and Foreign Service officer who recently resigned his post in Afghanistan. American families, Ho said at the end of his letter of resignation, I'm going to quote, must be reassured that their dead have sacrificed for a purpose worthy of futures lost, love vanished, and promised dreams unkept. I have lost confidence that such assurances can be made anymore. And our second guest will be Malala Joya, the youngest member elected to the Afghan parliament in 2005, but who has since been expelled, as she says, for raising her voice. She wrote in the UK Guardian recently, quote, the fact that I was kicked out of office while brutal warlords enjoyed immunity from prosecution for their crimes should tell you all you need to know about the democracy backed by NATO troops. Let me say thanks, by the way, to all of you who visited my site since the came into this time slot and those who emailed me feedback after the first two shows or signed up for the weekly email announcement. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, and media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Stick around for the next hour, then make it a habit and tell your friends. And if you want to know more about me and my work, check out terrencemcnally.net or email me at temcnally@mac.com. That's one word, temcnally@mac.com, if you want to receive my weekly email telling you who's going to be on and what we're going to talk about. When I decided I wanted to deal with Afghanistan this week, I thought immediately of three possible guests. Malala Joya and Matthew Ho are two of those. And the third is Anthony Basevich. He's a retired military man and the author of a wonderful book, The Limits of Power. I'm impressed every time I catch him on TV or in print. He's clear-spoken, principled. He challenges the U.S. to give up empire, and he considers himself a conservative, and I recommend that you check him out. But Matthew Ho is our first guest. He's a former Marine captain with combat experience in Iraq, and he served in uniform at the Pentagon and as a civilian in Iraq and at the State Department. And this summer, he was the senior U.S. civilian in Zabul province, a Taliban hotbed. In September, Ho became the first U.S. official known to resign in protest over the Afghan war. His four-page letter of resignation explains that he became convinced that our war in that country will not only inevitably fail, but that it is fueling the very insurgency that we're trying to defeat. He points out that, quote, next fall the United States occupation will equal in length the Soviet Union's own physical involvement in Afghanistan. I have doubts and reservations about our current strategy and planned future strategy, but my resignation is based not upon how we are pursuing this war, but why and to what end. In his Salon blog, Glenn Greenwald, writing about Ho's resignation, asks, I'm going to quote Greenwald now, how long are we going to continue to do this? We invade and occupy a country, and then we label as insurgents or even terrorists the people in that country who fight against our invasion and occupation. We then insist that we must remain in order to defeat the insurgents and terrorists, who are largely composed of people whose only cause for fighting is our presence in their country. All the while, we clearly exacerbate the very problem we're allegedly attempting to address, terrorism, by predictably and inevitably increasing anti-American anger and hatred through our occupation, which, no matter the strategy, inevitably entails our killing innocent civilians. The Pentagon's own 2004 report concluded, quote, this is quoting the Pentagon, negative attitudes and the conditions that create them are the underlying sources of threats to America's national security. Direct American intervention in the Muslim world has paradoxically elevated the stature of and the support for Islamic radicals. Welcome, Matthew Ho, to KPFK and Free Forum.
Thank you, Terrence.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. Can you tell us a little bit about your path prior to this difficult decision you made in September? You know, things like, did you always want to be a soldier or a Marine? When did you serve in Iraq? What did you do there? Were you involved in combat? And were you also involved in Reconstruction?
Sure. I joined the Marine Corps in 1998, January of 1998, almost 2.5 years after I graduated college. I had worked in finance for some publishing companies in both Boston and New York City before I decided to join the Marine Corps. And I was in the Marine Corps, both active and reserve, for 10 years. I served in Japan, as well as had time in the Pentagon. I was on the Secretary of Navy's staff, so I got to see senior-level decision-making in 2002-2004. I left active duty in 2004 and joined the Department of Defense as a U.S. government civilian and went to Iraq to participate in reconstruction programs. Served a year there in Tikrit, Iraq, which is the birthplace of Saddam Hussein, and was there from May 04 to May 2005. As, like I said, a Department of Defense civilian, I was on a State Department team that was embedded with the U.S. Army there. And so primarily did reconstruction as well as some governance-type work for that year. I came home, went to work as a consultant to the State Department and was on the State Department's Iraq desk for about 4 or 5 months before I had the opportunity to take command of a Marine Corps Reserve Combat Engineer Company. I took that opportunity and deployed with Charlie Company, 4th CEB, was the unit I was with, and we went to back to Iraq in September of 2006 and were there until end of April, beginning of May 2007 in Anbar Province. And during that was primarily combat operations, operations that were part of the surge campaign of fall 2006 through spring 2007.
Wow. So you actually, your combat came very late in terms of your relationship to the Pentagon, the State Department, your Marine Service, and so on.
Correct. I mean, my first deployment, while I was not directly involved in combat, of course, the nature of the warfare there, there are IEDs, there's indirect fire, there are small arms engagements that, by necessity, you find yourselves involved in, because in a position like I was in, where you're out every day working with the local Iraqi population, whether it be Iraqi government officials or Iraqi engineers or the Iraqi military or just Iraqi civilians, you find yourself out every day. So you happen into those circumstances. So the combat end in terms of direct participation, yes, not until my second time there, but indirectly, yes. So plenty of not great things my first time in Iraq.
Yeah, well, because of the Fort Hood incident recently, people are finally paying some attention. They're alarmed about the state of returning soldiers. What was your experience when you returned from Iraq?
You know, my first time, it wasn't so bad. I had lost some Iraqis who had worked for me, some men who had been on my payroll, who had been some of my engineers who had developed quite a good relationship with, and I had lost several of them. And, you know, coming home was a very stressful year, so coming home, it was difficult. It took a couple months to decompress, but there were no lingering issues and certainly nothing I would characterize as any type of emotional distress. My second time, however, coming home, I'd had one particular incident that really affected me, and I came home and spent a few months dealing with a bout of what's classified as survivor guilt. I was in a helicopter accident. Four men died. I survived, and I, several months after the accident, was just overwhelmed by this guilt that I had not done more to save those men. And it took me several months of to get through that feeling, and it took really the loss of a relationship as well as several other things in my life to realize that, hey, I need to do something to help myself or it's only going to get worse. But it really was. You hear about these instances where you have this period of blackness or this wave of distress just takes over you, and you read about it and you understand it, but when it happens to you, it's really overwhelming, and it can happen to anybody. I never thought what happened to me, and it happened to me.
Right, and I'm sure that I never thought it would happen to me is echoed by so many who go over there and return.
Exactly. You receive training on this. The military is pretty good in terms of training. You understand it, particularly at the officer level. You understand what your Marines are going to go through. And I stood in front of my Marines countless times, and my first sergeant did, and my platoon commanders and platoon sergeants did, and we said to our guys, listen, if you're having problems, you need to talk to somebody. It doesn't have to be a chaplain or a psychiatrist or anyone. It could be your wife, girlfriend, your buddy, but you need to talk to somebody. But then when it happens to you, you don't follow your own advice.
I believe it. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Matthew Ho. He's a former Marine Iraq War vet, the experiences we've just been talking about, and he recently resigned his role with the Foreign Service in Afghanistan because he felt he couldn't participate in the ongoing occupation. You can learn more about these issues that we're going to be speaking about today at RethinkAfghanistan.com. RethinkAfghanistan is one word, .com. Let's move ahead so that we can deal with your resignation and the whys and so on. And so tell me, what were you doing in Zabul? What was your assignment? What were the kinds of experiences that I think you were there 5 months at the point at which you resigned that led to your needing to resign?
Sure. Actually, when I first arrived in Afghanistan, I was assigned to Jalalabad, which is a fairly large city, roughly in between the capital of Afghanistan, Kabul, and Peshawar, Pakistan, which is the large city in western Pakistan. And Jalalabad is roughly in between there. It's always been a center of commerce and a center of trade, and because of its position along that trunk road between those two cities. So I was assigned there. I worked with an Army brigade. I was the acting political advisor to the Army brigade commander there. And he was responsible for military operations for the U.S. in four provinces along the Pakistan border. And I spent roughly about 2 months there or so before I was moved down to Zabul province. And down in Zabul province, I was a political advisor on a United States provincial reconstruction team, which is a team of approximately 90 to 100 Americans, and we had about 40 Afghan guards who worked with us as well. We were responsible for doing operations within the province along the lines of reconstruction, development, and governance. So it's everything to trying to get the government to actually serve the people in some capacity that we recognize back here as representative government, and then also to the engineering ends of it, of building roads, putting wells in, building schools, those kinds of things. My specific duties were to work daily with the Afghan provincial governor, who was an appointee of President Karzai. We were co-located with the provincial governor there. Their building was right next to our base. We had just had a simple gate that separated us. So our contact was constant. And during the 3 months or so I was there, it was daily interaction with the Afghan government, as well as getting out and visiting villages and cities within Zabul as often as possible.
Okay. And I've read that you were assigned to research the response to a question asked by Admiral Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and that experience, influenced you.
Sure, yes. That was back when I was in Jalalabad, and Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, had visited, and he wanted to know why we were in one particular valley. So it wasn't assigned to me. I was just part of the group of guys who were answering this question on the brigade staff. Basically, Admiral Mullen wanted to know why we were in the Korangal Valley. And the Korangal, many of your listeners may recognize, the Korangal is in Kunar province. It's on the Pakistan border. It's been described by the New York Times as the Valley of Death. It was on the cover of Time magazine. It's probably the most recognizable site of battle in Afghanistan for the American public. The Korangal is all of 15, 20 kilometers long, maybe. It's not very big. There's only about 10,000 people who live in it. And they speak their own language. So in the year 2009, you have a valley of people who speak their own language. So right off the bat, you're thinking, why do we have troops in there? We really should have probably anthropologists in there.
Mm-hmm.
So what had happened was we found that as early as late 2004 or so, we had sent American forces in there, and they really hadn't been engaged much, very little contact with the enemy. So we were wondering why over the course of 4 years, did it go from just really two contacts with the enemy in 8 months to the Valley of Death. What we found was that we went in there, and then this is, like we said, this is a population of 10,000 people. Their only trade is the timber trade, and they've been doing that for generations, for probably hundreds of years. And when they engage in this, when they cut the trees down and move their lumber, they don't even, for the most part, we don't even think they really even leave the mouth of their valley. We think they go to the mouth of the valley, and a middleman picks it up, or they go to a pass someplace. These people are only concerned about their valley and have very little interest in the world outside of it. So what happens is we go in there, we end up garrisoning it. Then the Afghan National Army and Afghan National Police come in with us as well. They are not representative of the Korangalis. They're not representative of the region. They are outsiders. One of my beliefs and thesis behind how I feel about Afghanistan is that this is a civil war. This Afghan National Army and this Afghan National Police, they're representative of the other side of the civil war, the side that the Korangalis would not be on. And so what you basically have, you have people who are fighting us to get out of the valley. And that was the conclusion we came with, was that if we left a Korangal of literally dozens of American casualties, nothing would happen. The Korangalis were not going to line up and march on Kabul next. They were just going to go about their business and be happy we weren't there.
So, in other words, this, for you, is kind of a microcosm of the whole situation?
Exactly. This is the first one I really researched and really saw clearly. Because for every, and here's, this, like I said, my problem, for every valley that we're in, there's like 100 that we're not. And it comes down to also an issue, too, an internal issue with Afghanistan, because what's behind this, as I started talking about the timber trade, it really comes down to the issue of taxes. Really what happens now is that you have the Afghan central government going into the Korangal Valley and going into countless other valleys and saying, yeah, that those mountains that you're cutting your trees down on, that your family's been cutting trees down on for generations, they don't belong to you. They belong to the central government, and you don't have to pay tax on that in some form. And so you think, what are we doing involved in this? Why are our troops fighting and dying over something like
right,
this?
Right, we're riding.
It has nothing to do with our security or safety as a nation.
So in other words, the work you were doing with all the best intentions led you to this conclusion that you sort of stated before, that we are enmeshed in a civil war, and I don't think that most Americans know that. What is that civil war?
The civil war is basically a civil war that's been going on since 1973, since when the king was deposed. It's probably been going on for longer than that. But in terms of the violent aspect of it or how readily apparent it is, then it particularly picked up in 1977-78 with the Sour Revolution, which then ultimately led to the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan. But the Civil War is basically, as I see it, for the most part, within Pashtun society, between the urban, the educated, the secular, the progressive, the modern, versus the rural, the poor, the religious, the traditional. And it's a very, very much a societal class within that society, within Afghanistan. One of the ways it was described to me, interestingly, was from an Afghan National Army general who was very proud of the fact that his province, Badakhshan province, was one of the first provinces to start the revolution in 77 or 78, as he said. And he said the reason why they started the revolution was because the government came to our villages and asked us what our wives' names were. And so really it's an intrusion on a traditional rural life that is resented. And that is really the spark that began the Civil War that has continued throughout the 80s, throughout the 90s, and up until now. Most rural Afghans that you meet, the folks who are taking funding from the Taliban to fight us and who are fighting us because we're occupying them or the central government's occupying them, they really see no difference in the central government, whether it was the communist government, whether it was the post-communist government under Rabini, whether it was the Taliban government or the Karzai government. They see the central government really as one and the same, as an intrusion on their lives and on their way of life.
So you came to this decision to resign and wrote a 4-page letter to your superiors. I think in our conversation so far, you've stated many of the reasons that end up in that letter, but if you want to summarize, you know, again, what were the points that lead you to such a tough decision?
Sure. Like I said, we just spoke about the Korangal and then the realization that in the east where our troops are engaged, that's the reason for most of the combat is that we are occupying a population. And then when I moved down to the south, I saw much of the same, and I really started to understand the Civil War aspect of it. The other part, too, is this, that this does not do anything to defeat al-Qaeda. I think most people most folks in the intelligence community, most folks within diplomatic and military circles, agree that Al-Qaeda is an organization that is only a few thousand strong and that exists in these small networked cells that don't require any type of political or state support for their success or for their operations. That Al-Qaeda primarily exists really on the Internet, and that if we withdraw from Afghanistan, Al-Qaeda is not going to rush back into Afghanistan because they don't need to. They already have as many failed states as they want to have operations in, and they don't require a landmass to conduct their operations. So that realization, too, that, you know, this is not doing anything to defeat Al-Qaeda, that we've got 60,000 troops here, we've got families that are sacrificing really, really good and talented young men for something that's not going to make us safer. And then also, too, just the understanding as well that Pakistan should be our priority. Pakistan, because of its nuclear weapons and because of its relationship with India and because of its prominence in the region there, that should be our priority. And our presence in Afghanistan, I think a lot of people will agree, has only destabilized Pakistan these last 5, 6, 7, 8 years. So those are really the three key points that drove me to this decision. Nothing I write about in my letter is unique or novel to myself. I heard you reference Professor Pasevich earlier. I know he has been saying some of these things for many years now, as well as within military and diplomatic circles. I've received a lot of support, and a lot of these thoughts of mine that I wrote were things that I had discussed with people before, or people had discussed with me. So nothing I say is novel or unique, and it's certainly not. There was never any eureka moment in writing this. It was basically just a compilation of 5 months.
Right, and what I hear is that it wasn't that you were the first one to come up with this. It was just that it drove you to take this personal action. There's a way that I like to approach certain issues, and it's to say, if it's broke, let's fix it. And it's basically three questions. First question is, how do we know that our role in Afghanistan is broken?
What we're doing there doesn't pass the common sense test. I think there's a general agreement that the people we are fighting are fighting us because we're occupying them, as well as an agreement among a lot of people that, Al-Qaeda does not exist in a form that garrisoning troops in one country is going to defeat it. So I think there's a logic test that this fails to pass. And I think that's how we know that this is not working.
Very good. And how did our engagement there get broken? What are the causes?
We lost focus on Afghanistan with the Iraq War, and I certainly don't want to get bogged down to the politics of that. Up until now, I've had tremendous bipartisan support on this issue, and I definitely would like to keep that. So,
well, I've noticed, by the way, just for listeners, I've noticed in reading other interviews you've had and so on, that you are very careful to say, let's not argue about the past, let's deal with the situation we face.
Exactly. You know, and that's a really a personal, emotional thing for me, because we have kids out there. I mean, some mother probably just lost her son today, or some wife just probably lost her husband today in Afghanistan, or maybe multiple people did. So to squabble about petty partisan politics from 2004, 2005, 2006 really is a disservice to those brave young men out there. And we need to move forward. We need to analyze where we're at right now and go forward. But, you know, I think a lot of our involvement in Afghanistan, the need to be there, within domestic concerns, it comes down to a fear of another 9/11, which is a well-justified fear, because we as a nation, we cannot have an attack like that ever again. Just for for our economy's sake, an attack like that right now would be terrible for us. And so Al-Qaeda needs to be our primary threat. How we lost focus on that, I'm not sure how we got into this point where we're just continuing to march lockstep forward, doing the same thing over and over again in Afghanistan, one year after next. Well, hey, it hasn't been working, so let's just double our forces and be able to work again. I'm not sure why we have that think, why there's that group think, why there's that mentality, but it exists and it needs to change. And we need to recognize that the threat's Al-Qaeda, the priority should be Pakistan, and that having these troops, our troops there, 60,000 troops or maybe up to 100,000 troops, will not defeat Al-Qaeda and will not stabilize Pakistan.
Okay. Finally, the how do we fix it? What are the solutions? And I have a feeling I'm asking you two questions in that. One is, basically what you were just alluding to is that what do you think is the would be best for the U.S. in Afghanistan? The second might be what should listeners do if they agree with that?
Sure. Okay, thanks. My recommendation is this: stop fighting the people who are fighting us only because we're occupying them or because the central government is occupying them. Recognize that it's a civil war and that civil wars only end through political reconciliation. They can also end by one side decimating the other or just both sides tiring of the fighting and segregating themselves from one another. Neither one of those are good courses of action for us or for the world community or for the people of Afghanistan. So we need to recognize that it's a civil war, and we need to really, really push hard for political reconciliation. I don't believe the Karzai administration has any interest whatsoever in reconciliation. They've not done any of it in the last 8 years, and I don't believe they will do any reconciliation attempts in the next several years. Like I said, stop combat operations in those valleys and villages where people are fighting us, where our presence only fuels the insurgency, where it only legitimizes our enemies' claims as well as the claims and justifies al-Qaeda's existence. We need to look at re-engaging, but doubling our efforts with Pakistan. And I'm not a Pakistan expert, so I don't know if that means go really hard on Pakistan or go real easy, give them everything they need with no strings attached or lean real heavily on them. I'm not sure which way to go on that, but that needs to be our focus.
That should be the conversation that we're having 6 months from now, a year from now, rather than this one. But let me ask, when you say reconciliation, that's reconciliation between whom?
Between the various factions within Afghanistan. And you got to be very careful because we don't want Afghanistan to return to a state of warlordism. But we also can't have a country where the vast majority of the rural population is distanced or not included in the government. So you're going to have to bring in members of the Taliban into the government. And that in order to get true reconciliation, in order to get an Afghanistan that is not a failed state, you are going to need to have members of the Taliban in the Afghanistan government.
Okay, so that sounds like an enormous challenge. And that second part of that question, which I ask, is what should listeners do? We've gotten to the point where we've got to end this interview, but I would just say basically learn as much as you can. Look at rethinkafghanistan.com for a lot of information. Google Matthew Ho, and you can see other things he has said. And then just make sure that you are keeping your representatives informed of your feelings. I've been speaking with Matthew Ho. He's the former Marine Iraq War vet. He recently resigned his role with the Foreign Service in Afghanistan because he couldn't participate in the continued occupation. I recommend you look him up, as I said, on Google. Read that letter of resignation. Thank you, Matthew Ho, and continue to keep up your good work.
Thank you, Terrence.
For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com to the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements of upcoming guests and issues, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at iTunes. Thanks to G, my engineer, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, Mark Maxwell in production, and most of all to you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely.
You're listening to the Progressive Voices Network, and here's a clip from Tara Buster with comedian Tara Devlin from RDTDaily.com.
When they talk about the deep state, to them, it's anybody who gets in the way. It's anybody who believes in democracy. You're in bed with the deep state. What the? Any lefty that talks about the deep state, you're not a lefty, you're an idiot. Any right-wing person who talks about the deep state, I'm expecting that from them because they're stupid. But the deep state, what's the deep state? Anybody who gets in the way of fascism, that's the deep state. Anybody who is maybe has a glimmer in their eye for democracy. Anybody who wants to promote the general welfare over the welfare of the corporate elite, that's the deep state. You know, when they talk about draining the swamp, now that's another tag word. You know, when I heard drain the swamp as a normal person, I translated that to getting rid of money in politics. That's the swamp. It's the oligarchy. It's the big moneyed interests who have used government as an appendage to their affairs, right? No, when they talk about draining the swamp, how did I know that they meant that they would be getting on their knees for Goldman Sachs? That's what they meant. It's more of a graphic image. draining the swamp for them. They're literally filleting Goldman Sachs. That's draining the swamp.
This is Tara Devlin from RDTDaily.com. That was a clip from my show, Tara Buster. Join us for the live recording every Saturday at 6 p.m. Eastern at FYINation.com. Or catch the replays starting Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern on Progressive Voices, or anytime on demand on the Progressive Voices app. Support the Progressive Voices Network and tell your friends. Remember, we stick together, we win.